Welcome to a bonus episode of the Religious Studies Project. My name is Christopher Cotter. My co-host, David Robertson, is not here with me today. I'm in my own living room recording this for you. But he has been behind the scenes making this podcast possible with his audio wizardry. So thanks, David. As ever, we are presented in association with the British Association for the Study of Religions. You can check out their website at www.basr.ac.uk. Now, as our regular listeners will be aware, we're having our summer break at the moment, and we'll be coming back in mid-September with a full back to our weekly schedule of interesting podcasts for you. But what we've got today is the annual lecture from the Non-Religion and Secularity Research Network, which was recorded in November 2012 at Conway Hall in London. This was their second annual lecture, so hopefully there'll be plenty more. And it is Dr. Matthew Ngelke of the London School of Economics talking on the topic In Spite of Christianity, Humanism and Its Others in Contemporary Britain. This recording, because of my relationship with the NSRN as well as the RS Project, we help each other out by we'll disseminate the podcast on their behalf, but it will be published on both websites. Due to sort of logistical constraints, being a live lecture and the recording, it is not as perfect as we might like it, but we're very glad to have the recording there. So just apologies for that if the sound quality isn't perhaps as good as you're used to. Also due to the logistics of it, it does jump in somewhat a few minutes into the lecture, so you know you don't really get the introductions and things that you would have got were you there, but hopefully you'll still enjoy it because I think it's an absolutely fantastic lecture. Good news on that front as well is that the full text of the lecture is available online, and we will link to that from the podcast page. But for now, I'll hand you over to Matthew Ngelke, and you'll hear from us some more in mid-September. Thanks for listening.
And with all such organizations, BHA keeps a risk register in accordance with guidelines set up by the Charity Commission. It's important that staff and trustees are considering all of the risks that the association might face and how, where possible, to minimize them. Risk registers are odd things. They are full of any number of potential threats to an organization's finances, operational capabilities, and other concerns, such as reputation. They need to be taken seriously. And yet the extent to which such risks can be measured and minimized is not always clear. What is the risk of a computer meltdown, of broader economic trends affecting the balance sheet? At the BHA, the coding system was based on a numerical scale. Any risk above a certain number triggered discussion and indicated, as one trustee put it, quote, what we should worry about. The group convened for about 2 hours to consider the document upon which the risks were arrayed. It was a productive meeting for Andrew Copson, the CEO, and three trustees who made up the committee, because it allowed them to have conversations about several key issues. In at least a few instances, those conversations led to concrete plans and actions. But for some entries on the register, the committee was not clear how to assess the given risks and how to score them relative to one another. The difference between a medium-level risk and a high-level risk was usually clear enough, at least in their minds. But within the medium-level risk band, what might the difference be between, say, a 7 and a 9? As it happens, humanists are often people who make a concerted effort to extol the virtues of reason, rationality, and evidence-based approaches to judgments about the world and our knowledge of it. Whether or not this made a genuine difference to the meeting, it was clear at several points that they were uncomfortable just weighing it when it came to their deliberations. And one trustee in particular seemed to get frustrated by the lack of clear criteria with which to assess some of the risks. In short, it seemed to me, this frustrated trustee didn't want to do what humanists never want to do, but which the governors of organizations, all organizations, sometimes do in fact do, which is to say, make things up just a bit as they go along. humanists have a particular problem with made-up things. These are people who promote a naturalistic view of the universe, as the BHA puts it on its website, based on the principles of science and the faculty of reason. So in between the productive conversations, there were moments of frustration about the Kafkaesque demands of bureaucracy and audit culture that all organizations face. The most significant, to my mind, had to do with risk O19, referred to in the document as premises needing major repairs. William, as I'll call him, who was running the meeting, said that this entry included acts of nature. It wasn't a high-level risk. It wasn't a big concern, but he did mention it. Notice he didn't say acts of God, one of the other trustees interjected quickly with a smile on her face. I change this on documents all the time, William replied. William had a lot of experience in the world of business. And the solicitors always change it back, he went on. They say act of God has a legal definition, but it has nothing to do with God. How is it in this day and age, the trustees wondered, that professionals could countenance the use of such language? Indeed, for lawyers, legislators, insurers, and other important people in modern Britain, an act of God is a legitimate expression, even though it would be understood as nothing more than, quote, the operation of uncontrollable natural resources, or forces, according to the Oxford English Dictionary. God has nothing to do with it. This small exchange tells us something important about humanists. For humanists, it is very important to break with the past, in particular, to expunge the signs of religion from society and its workings, especially where those signs have force and meaning within political and legal systems. Humanists are almost always staunch secularists, too. So this hybridized term, act of God, blurring the boundaries of semantic precision in a secular age, using the supernatural to signify the natural, is precisely the kind of thing that bothers them. If humanists have their way, acts of God will become acts of nature. And in the BHA's own risk register, at least, they have become so. 3 weeks after the risk assessment, the Board of Trustees was presented with an updated register at its quarterly meeting. On the basis of deliberations in January, many changes had been made, and O19 had been consolidated with another O item, O stood for operational risks, to become O9, which was dubbed acts of nature. Looking over the register, one of the trustees paused at O9. I approve of acts of nature, he said. He hadn't been at the meeting in January, but he knew all about this frustrating survival in legalese. Everyone smiled and laughed. Before conducting research on humanists, I spent 3 years conducting research on evangelically minded Christians in England, especially among those who are seeking a more prominent public role for faith. These evangelicals and the humanists often serve as others to each other, opponents or at least opposites in the public sphere on any given issue, to do with anything from reform, the House of Lords, to debates over assisted dying. In both the public sphere and in day-to-day conversations and reflections, it is common to hear evangelical Christians or others critical of humanist causes claim that what humanists want is not so much a break with the past, but a repackaging of it. Humanism often gets cast as another kind of faith. For some evangelicals, the fact that humanists have risk assessment meetings and police language so closely would be taken as signs of humanist hypocrisy. In terms of the risk assessment meetings, I think the evangelicals would cry foul over the fact that humanists are so often critical of organized religion. Perhaps humanism is not as free-thinking as it claims to be. In terms of banning the phrase acts of God, certain of these evangelicals would see it as dogmatic and closed-minded. In short, these evangelicals would say humanism looks a lot like the religions it claims to get beyond. The situation in Britain can be good to think when it comes to recent discussions within anthropology about what has come to be called continuity thinking. Simply put, this is the argument that anthropologists are not very good at documenting social change. Their models of analysis tend to stress the ways in which cultures endure over time. It is, of course, a truism to say that we can only understand what we don't know in terms of what we do know, in terms of the cultural resources and registers at our disposal. To this extent, continuity thinking makes sense, and we should expect humanism in Britain to be articulated, at least in part, in relation to Western Judeo-Christian traditions. Indeed, there are prominent members of the BHA, such as the author Philip Pullman, who define themselves as Church of England atheists and such like. These links are often acknowledged and embraced. I met one member of the BHA who has arranged to be buried in the graveyard of his parish church. Although an atheist and humanist, this man has participated in the life of his village, and this has meant participating in the life of the church. At the same time, as I have indicated, there are important ways in which organized humanism wants to shift the terms of reference. Anthropologists who study Christianity have helped drive home the importance of taking culture change seriously, and in particular taking seriously the kinds of radical transformations often associated with becoming Christian. This is particularly true with reference to non-Western colonial and post-colonial contexts, the traditional arenas of anthropological research. The point has been to show that Christianity matters. Christianity matters in Papua New Guinea, it matters in the Philippines, it matters in Zimbabwe. Christianity is not some appendage to political and economic forces, and it can change, sometimes radically, the ways in which people think and act in relation to themselves, their families, other people, and the workings of the world. One of my arguments in this lecture is that anthropology, alongside other social sciences, and indeed many social commentators, have done much less work on the implications and influences of continuity thinking when it comes to our intellectual historical resources. Agitated at least in part by triumphalist claims of the Enlightenment, or at least a certain reading of the Enlightenment, to have broken with the Christian past, and the allied version of secularization theory, in which religion is supposed to decline and die with the rise of modernity, anthropologists and many other kinds of people have been at pains to show how Christianity or religion or enchantment persist, especially when they are talking about the West. So when it comes to the global South, the argument is that everything is now different, in no small part because of Christianity. When it comes to the West, the argument is that nothing's really changed, in no small part because of Christianity. When I began working on humanism, I started keeping track of where this argument appears. Before long, I had to stop because it was so common. Consider these quotes, which have to do with the ways in which the secular disciplines, the secular social sciences, relate to their theological forebears. For these, which have to do with related arguments about politics, these arguments are equally relevant and common to social and cultural history. There are many relatively anodyne versions of this. Here, for example, Gianni Vattimo making the point that we could not understand Western literature if we took Christianity out of it. There are more polemical points that are made in this vein from philosophers such as Richard Rorty, commentators and journalists such as Andrew Brown, and even more controversial, I think, and specifically nationalist arguments, which have to do with the place of Christianity within the nation, Bishop Michael Nasr Ali being a good example. Right? All of these quotes, I have to clarify, I'm taking out of anything like a proper context. And there are several different projects, intentions, and agendas represented in these statements. But what they all suggest is that things are not what they seem, and that the transformation promised by a certain reading of the Enlightenment never really materialized. So, the question here then is, for me, what difference doesn't Christianity make? What do humanists do in spite of Christianity? How do the differences and indifferences get produced and legitimized? How can reflections on humanism's relation to Christianity and to religion more generally help us understand the contemporary contours of faith? Now, one of the most important aspects of the BHA's work is to foster and serve local humanist groups. The BHA works in part at a national level on issues of policy and via public engagement and debate. But helping humanism flourish at the grassroots level is an important complement to this. There were over 60 local humanist groups in England and Wales at the time of my research, a few of which predate the BHA or were otherwise formed independently. There are, moreover, some humanist and atheist groups which are not formally affiliated with the BHA, and even a few, just a few, which are affiliated to the BHA that seem to hold Gower Street in very poor regard. It can be very difficult even for humanists to appreciate voluntary associations to voluntarily associate. There is, in any case, no requirement for people who attend a local group to join the BHA, and many local group members don't. All the same, many do. And for several years, there has been a staff member at the BHA job, at the BHA, whose job is to work with local groups, and it's common for Andrew Copson and other staff to give talks at local group meetings. The BHA also lists group meetings and events on its website and email circulars. Attendance at local groups can range from a handful of people to 50 or 60 or more. Meetings are usually once monthly on a weekday evening and held in a pub or a community center, although a few groups meet in other venues to include Quaker meeting houses. Many groups charge a nominal fee for membership, although in my experience this was not strictly enforced and a cause of slight embarrassment for group secretaries and treasurers. I spent a year attending a local group as part of my research, a group which I'll refer to as the Thames Path Humanists. In the interests of full disclosure, I should probably admit that one of the reasons I chose the Thames Path Humanists is because they meet in a pub about 10 minutes walk from my house in Zone 4 London. But as luck would have it, this was a very interesting group to study, because they did lots of things. The Thames Path group was very active in terms of meetings and community involvement. There were also several key members of the group who had strong relationships with the BHA. One committee member, for instance, whom I'll go on to discuss in more detail, is a BHA-accredited celebrant. This is someone who conducts non-religious or humanist funerals, weddings, and naming ceremonies. And as many of you will know, celebrants are an integral part of the BHA. Another sometime committee member, Thames Path, had worked at the BHA. In addition to the monthly meeting in the pub, the Thames Path group also had a monthly coffee morning at a theater cafe, and for a time, a monthly Sunday roast dinner at a different pub. Although, shortly into my research, the Sunday dinner stopped happening because not many people came. This was blamed on the horribleness of the pub in question, though, not lack of interest, and I can confirm the pub was, it's a horrible pub. They realized that. Thames Path also had an annual summer garden party and a Christmas party, and participated in local community days. Toward the end of 2011, the chairman of the group arranged for members to help out at a local soup kitchen in rotation with members of the nearby Unitarian Church. And they have since also started a book group. The first meeting of the Thames Path Humanists took place in January 2007. That preceding fall, the membership officer at the BHA had noticed that a significant area of London didn't have a local group, and sent out an email to BHA members in a certain set of postcodes asking if anyone wanted to start one. Two of the people who replied to the call were Brian and Sage. They have gone on to become close fellow travelers and friends. Both had joined the BHA because of the ceremonies work. In 2002, Brian got married. Neither he nor his wife are religious, and they wanted the wedding to reflect that. He had heard a little bit about the BHA, and he knew they provided non-religious weddings. It was fantastic, he told me, with a warm glow. All their friends said it was the best wedding they'd ever been to, an achievement Brian put down in large part to the personal touches and focus. Sage turned to the BHA for her mother's funeral. She didn't really know at first that she was turning to the BHA. She just knew that neither she nor her mother wanted a church funeral, and a colleague of hers from work at a small independent publishing house put her in touch with a woman from Clapham who conducts funerals and happened to be a BHA celebrant. The celebrant let Sage and her family decide all the details of the service. And it was amazing, Sage told me. It was very empowering and felt very personal. Neither Brian nor Sage knew much about humanism per se when they availed themselves of the BHA's services. After the ceremonies, they each looked into what the BHA was about. They each went to the website. And I thought, I have to put my money where my mouth is, Brian recalled. This is what I think, and this is what these people are doing, so why don't I support them? I liked what I saw. I identified with it, Sage said. She joined and enjoyed the newsletters. Then she went on to read some books about humanism. Sage was particularly taken by the work of two philosophers, both prominent supporters of the BHA, A.C. Grayling and Richard Norman. And I did feel happy then to call myself a humanist, she said. This process of realization is extremely common among BHA members. Humanists recognize humanism as something which doesn't need to be articulated as such. Many people only recognize themselves as humanists after reading about it or talking to someone else who is. I even met BHA members who went on the word of a friend or colleague. Audrey, for instance, the Thames Path member who had also worked for the BHA, was dubbed a humanist by a colleague. I was a teacher for 20-odd years, she told me, and I used to have interesting discussions with my colleagues, many of whom were Christians, including the head of R.E., who used to say, oh, maybe you're a Buddhist, and give me something on about Buddhism. I'd say, no, not quite right, you know. Well, maybe you're a Quaker, she'd say. I don't believe in God. That doesn't matter, apparently. But eventually she decided that I was a humanist, so, you know, she put a label on my set of beliefs. Even the former CEO of the BHA, Hannah Stinson, told me that she had never identified as a humanist until she applied for the job of CEO. Exactly what realization means or involves may differ. In general, though, realization relies upon a strong version of reason as the key to thinking about the world. One which is, as an anthropologist might put it, pre-cultural and available to everyone. Realization humanists see themselves as enlightened moderns, even though they don't normally use that term, who have harnessed the power of an innate rationality and thrown off the shackles of superstition. Thinking, that is to say, which is guided by a belief in or commitment to the supernatural or unknown, especially when that commitment contradicts empirical evidence to the contrary. To be sure, this particular framing is not the only one in play. There were, moreover, several members of the BHA and Thames Path group who did not primarily identify as humanist. Some preferred terms like atheist, agnostic, or materialist. Some didn't like labels at all. Two members of the BHA staff refused to refer to themselves as humanist, and one, taking a classic liberal perspective, said it was a private matter and frankly no one's business, perhaps especially the inquiring anthropologists. In a survey I conducted of the BHA membership, one respondent even referred to herself as a Zen Buddhist. So there are all sorts. For people like Brian and Sage, though, what humanism provides is a positive label for what they believe. For them, as for many others, it is important to self-identify as a humanist because people ought to know what humanism is, even if they then go on to refuse that label. So the label itself has a mix of practical, political, and philosophical valences which, at least for the time being, cannot be discarded. Brian and Sage do not believe in God or anything divine or anything supernatural. Brian calls himself an atheist, but he subordinates this to his humanism because of that effort to be positive. Calling yourself an atheist, as after all, as many humanists pointed out to me, is defining yourself in negative terms. Sage also emphasized the need to be positive. It's nice to have found a label, she told me. But a lot of my friends are non-believers, and they're not interested in doing what I do or coming along. They just live their lives as non-believers. Brian's mother was raised in the Church of England, and his father was Jewish. He was steeped in both traditions, he told me. He even had a bar mitzvah because it meant so much to his father. Growing up, Brian attended synagogue in South London and got heavy doses of Anglicanism by his school, an established independent school in central London. Judaism in particular became important for his nuclear family. His mother had converted because of his father, and his mother and sister still attend the synagogue, a very liberal one, he told me. Brian, though, quote, never really bought it, and doesn't recognize himself as Jewish at all. And partly, he said, it's because as a child I didn't want to be different. It was all downside and no upside. The synagogue services are unutterably tedious. They go round and round and round in apparently no direction, and there's no decent tunes in them. I was forced to be a member of a club I didn't want to join. In terms of the Anglicanism he got at school, he told me, quote, I always knew in terms of underlying belief that, well, you know, it seemed pretty silly to me. Sage, who grew up in Africa and whose parents didn't want her to attend state schools, ended up for some period in a Catholic boarding school run by nuns, even though her father was, as she put it, very C of E, and her mother, Quaker Unitarian. The boarding school, it's safe to say, didn't endear her to Catholicism. But she was confirmed Anglican and felt, quote, quite religious for a little patch as a teenager. But I think it was just to belong, she said. Sage's family eventually moved to Australia, and then she moved to Britain, her parents eventually following. Sage has two children, and when they were born, she had them christened, because it was important to her to mark the births in some way, perhaps especially, as we'll soon hear, her second child. The christening was, as she put it, quote, the only thing you could do. In between having her two children, Sage had two quite traumatic miscarriages. I used to go and sit in the church a bit, she told me. Just, I think, to be on my own and think. I wasn't praying or anything. But church does provide things at times, or it has done. It's been the default to provide at times. What turned her away from the church, though, was the arrival in her neighborhood of a very conservative vicar. He tried to make it very high church, ridiculous, with incense and things. He was awful, she told me. At the time, she was also studying for a BA in women's studies as a mature student. It opens your eyes to organized religion, she said. I don't think you can do much academic study and still be religious, really, she told me. Brian and Sage held their first planning meeting for the Thames Path group in Brian's front room, along with some other people who had responded to the BHA prompt. Among them all, they told me it was very important to stress the positive side of humanism. In preparations for the Thames Path launch, Brian and Sage met with some other local humanist groups. Some were, and to become very important to them, but they were not always impressed. One group in particular struck them as very anti-religious, as they put it, and they didn't like that. And indeed, in my own experience of getting to know Brian and Sage, they didn't embody the more popularly public image of humanists, in particular that of the new atheists. At the Thames Path meetings, it was not unusual for one or another of the members or attendees to say something disparaging about religion during the course of the meeting, especially Christianity. Whenever this happened, though, Brian, who usually chaired discussions, tried to redirect the conversation. As I mentioned, however, Grayling's writings had been very important to Sage in terms of coming to humanism. And I remember being struck when, in an interview we conducted, Brian termed the ethos of the local group in the following way. We're anti-religious privilege and anti-stupid ideas, but we're not anti-religious, he said. The question this begs, of course, for the anthropologist is what the difference is between stupidity and religiosity. For Brian and Sage, as indeed I would argue many within what we might call very loosely the humanist movement more generally, this difference can be difficult to pinpoint. Simply put, though, what I would say is that humanists think what is stupid is belief. And belief here means accepting the truth or value of something without good evidence. Good evidence, in turn, means scientific evidence, evidence which is not subjective. Brian's list of stupid ideas might include thinking that ancient scriptures recounting the creation of the world and resurrections from the dead have any truth value in them, especially in the face of scientific evidence to the contrary. What's stupid is not listening to reason or common sense, both of which, for realization humanists, have fairly clear parameters. And yet, it would be a mistake to characterize the humanist ethos by relying too much on what humanists say explicitly, negatively about religion. It's true that if we listen to Brian and Sage's prompted recollections of coming to humanism, much of what we hear about religion and or religious is that they are silly, horrible, ridiculous, unutterably tedious. Yet within Brian and Sage's accounts, we also find hints of what they recognize as good about religion. Or, as I want to further explore now, what's good about it in spite of it. For both, obviously, as we have heard, it hinges at least in part on the redemption of ritual, that is to say, the ceremonies, recognizing that rites of passage are an important part not of being religious, but of being human. Sage has embraced this commitment in a particularly life-defining way. She is the core Thames Path group member I referred to earlier as going on to become a BHA-accredited celebrant. Sage now conducts funerals, weddings, and naming ceremonies on a weekly basis, or can if she wants to. The demand is certainly there. The goodness in religion also hinges for both Brian and Sage on a sense of belonging, and as Sage's life story in particular highlights, the sense of comfort and space for reflection a religion can provide. Brian, Sage, and other realization humanists like them would also want to qualify the emphasis on reason. Audrey, for example, who participated in a secular choir, and who championed often the virtues of poetry, art, and what many people might consider not-so-rational pursuits, wanted to make clear to me that reason is not the sole province of non-believers, even, I think, if her defense of the religious came out slightly as a backhanded compliment. Sometimes the humanist way of putting things implies that we are the only people who are reasonable, and that religious people aren't reasonable. And I think that's completely untrue, she said. They may have this irrational faith, but in the rest of their lives, they accept science, they buy medicine, they drive cars and travel in airplanes. They believe in gravity and all those things. They're not totally irrational. Wherever I went in the humanist networks, those who participated in local groups almost invariably said that they did so in order to interact with like-minded people. This phrase, like-minded people, is ironic because humanists are often emphatic about their independence, individuality, and autonomy. Recall again how for both Brian and Sage, what made the ceremonies they had, wedding and funeral, what made the ceremonies they arranged so meaningful is that they arranged them. They were the responsible parties. They were the ones setting the terms of reference. And the terms of reference were indexed to the human, not the numinous or divine. Yet within this irony is a paradox, or at least complication. For on the one hand, it is true that humanists often recoil from religion because, as free thinkers, they see one of religion's downsides, as Brian might put it, as conformity to a norm, groupthink, or not thinking at all. Religion is a club and they don't want to join. On the other hand, as I have stressed, there is within this tradition of humanism a conviction that reason lies within, and that its dictates, at least in general terms, are not subject to cultural contingencies or controls. During an informational session on humanism, for nurses training in palliative care, Andrew Coxon once said, "There was never a Mr. Human who founded humanism." Religion in the realization tradition has to be seen first and foremost as a cultural construct, something people make up. So the paradox, or at least complication, is that the humanist conception of free thinking is dependent upon the submission to reason. What resolves the paradox is the character of the submission. For within humanism, it is never the submission to a cultural fabrication. Submission to reason is no submission at all. It is a natural outpouring of common sense. To thine own self be true, that famous line from Shakespeare's Hamlet, inscribed above the stage in this very building, sums up what I'm talking about here. It suggests an inward-looking self, and this goes some way toward helping us understand the significance of looking for like-minded people. One of the important things about local groups, though, is that they bring together not only humanist minds, but humanist bodies. And humanism is embodied. Humanism is incorporated. These facts are often glossed over in public perceptions of humanism because these perceptions are dominated by intellectuals, scientists, philosophers, novelists, and serious journalists who trade primarily in words and regularly frame their critiques of religion as critiques of stupidity or irrationality. The main monthly meeting of the Thames Path humanists drew anywhere between 30 and 60 people, depending on the time of year and prominence of the topic or speaker. Many of the bodies accompanying the minds were, shall we say, older models. At Thames Path, as indeed in many local humanist groups, although not all, the members tend to be in their 50s or further, often retired or semi-retired. This was regularly put down to the fact, and not unreasonably so, that older people have more free time to attend evening meetings. The one young couple, which was very active in the group, did have the benefit of the set of parents locally who could babysit their daughter so they could come out to the pub. These humanist bodies sat together in the first floor room of the pub, which is arranged with four top tables and divided somewhat frustratingly by a half wall down the middle of the room. If there were more than 30 people, it could make following a speaker difficult, especially for the very elderly, some of whom were hard of hearing. Most members tolerated this meeting place not least given the welcome of the landlord, who let them have it for free, and didn't even seem to mind that, while most people got a pint of beer or a glass of wine, this was not a hard-drinking late-night bunch. Meetings began at 8 and they ended promptly at 10. Early on in 2011, the executive committee of the Thames Path group started encouraging people to come at 7 for socializing. About 10 people might show up for this, and sometimes they would get a snack or a light meal in addition to a drink. Whether or not space mattered, or should matter, was a point of contention within the Thames Path group. In a survey of the membership that Brian conducted in early 2012, and I have to be very grateful for how incredibly organized Brian is, someone opined for what the humanists had not. After 2,000 years, the Christian churches have at least one valuable asset. They have their very own premises in the form of church buildings, church halls, meeting houses, etc., as well as others with synagogues, mosques, and so on. Wouldn't it be useful if humanists, atheists, skeptics, and others had more than just Conway Hall in London? Which isn't to say Conway Hall isn't wonderful. But perhaps more than Conway Hall. Now, not everyone felt this way. During a group interview I conducted with several members of the Thames Path group, the issues of space and place led to a heated debate. And importantly, I would say, this debate was tied up with a debate about whether or not humanists should ever do anything more than talk, whether they might get together to sing, for instance, or express themselves in other corporate ways. So here are some singing humanists. These are not from the Thames Path group, but this is a rehearsal from the BHA choir. Some humanists love to sing. Some humanists think that you should not be a humanist and sing. All I want is conversation, declared Judy, one of the younger members of the Thames Path group, someone still in university. The point of this is the people, she said at another point. Benjamin, who was brought up in a self-consciously atheist household, disagreed. I think many people would be embarrassed, but the idea of having a song to start off humanist meetings with would be an excellent idea, he said. John, a semi-retired psychologist who is working on a book about atheism and spirituality, as well as training to become a celebrant, agreed with Benjamin. There's the Unitarians, who are virtually atheists. Now they've gone for architecture and for songs, and for those bits of religion that they think are worthwhile, and I think what they do is interesting. If you had all that, it would definitely put me off, Judy replied. Me too, said Nigel. He'd only been a member of Thames Path for a few months. He'd long considered himself an atheist, and perhaps above all, a committed environmentalist, but came along to the group with his partner Sally and enjoyed it. I don't want songbooks, and I don't want beautiful buildings, because that immediately to me introduces an influence which has nothing to do with the rational, but has everything to do with the emotional, which is for me not what humanism is about. Here we have a further sense of what like-minded people share. Of course, not always everything. But everything here was thrashed out with bonhomie, and the discussion wound down by everyone agreeing these differences of opinion would never split the group. That's exactly it, isn't it? Said Mark, Judy's husband. We can have this debate, and it doesn't matter. That's kind of the key thing. You'd have schisms in religion, they'd split. That won't ever happen here, he said. It wouldn't ever happen because these were reasonable people having reasonable disagreements. There is, in fact, a lot of conversation at humanist local meetings. Judy gets what she wants. The meetings at Thames Path were organized around a presentation by a member or a guest speaker. These were sometimes complemented by small group exercises. The discussions were often quite academic or intellectual and peppered with references to major thinkers, Diderot, Aristotle, John Stuart Mill, Bertrand Russell, and so on. Thames Path addressed a range of issues over the course of 2011, medical ethics, homeopathy, faith schools and the structure of state primary and secondary education, conceptions of the afterlife. Andrew Copson also came to give a talk, and in June, as with every June for the Thames Path, there was an annual general meeting with a special session devoted to the question, what is humanism, in an effort for newer members and attendees to have a focused discussion on the very idea. These monthly topics were decided upon by the executive committee of the group, but members were regularly canvassed for suggestions. And I think this range of topics is typical for local groups. Humanists talk about science, religion, ethics, and social issues. I want to make two observations about these sessions. The first, which I'll have to gloss over in the interest of time, but which I've already signaled as important, is that many of these sessions have to do with bodies, with their care, with their regulation by the state and oneself, and with their fate. It is worth emphasizing again, then, that despite the ways in which humanism is often portrayed as intellectualist, the intellectualism is often driven by more mundane material concerns, concerns of life and death, assisted dying, stem cell research, reproductive rights. Second observation, which I will dwell upon, is that all of these sessions came around at one point or another, and in one way or another, to a discussion of religion, superstition, faith, or some other concern with enchantment. Now, in many cases, this might be expected. A session on faith schools or the afterlife would most likely lead, at some point, to a discussion of religion or the supernatural. But even sessions that might have passed metaphysics-free never did. Take the case of the session on medical ethics. One could imagine that a discussion on ethics would indeed lead to a discussion on about religion, although a pet peeve of humanists is the assumption that religion is the wellspring of ethics. BHA, for example, gives out a pin which says good without God. Someone familiar with humanist sensibilities might therefore expect not to hear about religion in a session devoted to ethics. The presentation on medical ethics began secularly enough. The two invited speakers, a man and a woman, both with ties to the Thames Path group and both working in the field of healthcare, gave a PowerPoint presentation about the difficult choices that doctors and medical services face when it comes to allocating resources. The presentation began with a big picture overview of the different ethical models one might employ to make such choices: welfare maximization, medical need, merit, partiality, lottery. This was followed by a brief history of the founding of the National Health Service and the principles of universal health care in post-war Britain. The presentation ended with a streamlined version of the kinds of allocation choices faced by NHS trusts across England and Wales. In terms of the ethical models, the presenters spent the most time on a utilitarian approach developed by health economists called the quality-adjusted life year measure, or QAL. In this measure, decisions on how to allocate resources are determined by calculating the quality and quantity of life afforded by a treatment. The optimal measure is 1, which signals a return to long-term perfect health. If you get a 0, it means you're dead. In a table of the scale of values we were given, someone whose treatment left them bedbound was calculated to have a 0.4 quality, while someone with a severe working disability came out at 0.78. All things being equal then, applying quality means the resources would go to the disabled worker. As we were reminded, this model is far from perfect. This is something the presenters wanted to suggest and shouldn't necessarily be used in isolation. At the same time, it was being presented as a point of departure for humanist deliberations. Quality is something that humanists ought to take seriously. Nothing in this presentation referenced religion. So far, so secular. After a short break, the presenters broke us into 5 groups and tasked us with conducting an exercise called Who Gets the Kidney? 5 people are in desperate need of a kidney transplant and will die within the next 30 minutes if they do not receive one. Given the time element and the lack of resources, only 1 kidney is available. This means 4 people will die and 1 will live. Who gets the kidney? It was up to us to decide. I was in group 2 with Nigel and Sally, the environmentalist newcomers, along with 3 septuagenarians, 2 women and 1 man. One of these older women, Margaret, who was particularly frail, but always lively and sharp, was a regular attendee. I don't know whether it was because of Parkinson's disease or something else, but Margaret's head and arms often shook. It gave a soft warble to her voice, which contrasted with the sharp, silver-framed glasses that rested neatly on her pretty face. We all read through the cases and sat quiet for a minute. Nigel kicked things off. He ventured that the kidney should go to Mr. Brown, the drunk gambler, porno-starring tax dodger. The decision should be based on quality, he said. It's not ideal, he admitted, but, quote, it's as objective as it could be. Sally, his partner, disagreed, although she quickly said that her opinion was emotional, something which seemed to need to be excused. She was leaning towards Ms. Red, the young woman who wants to get married. Margaret, the elderly woman, shaking slightly, said that it was perfectly acceptable in her view to favor someone young. She said, we should be ageist. The elderly man, dressed smartly in a black check shirt and black tweed sports coat, admitted he would toss a coin. I couldn't make up my mind, he said. When we reconvened, the presenters asked each group to report back. Group 1 concluded that it should be Ms. Red. The man speaking on their behalf then added that they'd give Sister Mary White, the nun, an express ticket to her maker, and she'd probably appreciate that. He gave one of those little laughs that's half ironic, half serious. Group 3, who also applied quality, reckoned, though, that on this basis it should go to Mr. Brown. All the same, they overrid the number crunching and actually decided to give the kidney to Ms. Red. Group 4 went for Ms. Green because of the value of her profession. We didn't analyze it terribly, but we found it quite hard, said the rapporteur. In group 5, one person stressed that everyone has a right to life, and these decisions should therefore be lotteries, just like what the elderly man in my group had suggested. As a whole, though, group 5 concluded that it should go to Mr. Brown. Not for his well-being, though, but for the sake of his children. Now, I cannot say why the presenters included in their example Sister Mary White as their virtuous yet tragic patient. They might well have included a United Nations peacekeeper or a doctor from Doctors Without Borders. What I argue is that it's part of a more general picture of what we're seeing of humanism's relation to religion. In spite of themselves, I think humanists relate to religion. As the session was winding down, a man from one of the other groups had something to say. He wanted to make what he called a personal remark. He was very nervous. This was an interesting session, he said, but there's something disturbing because of the joking. This isn't a joking matter. Everyone went still for a moment. Once again, we see how being like-minded doesn't mean being single-minded. And once again, we see how a normative logic of humanism, which is supposed to privilege reason and rationality, is much more complicated, reconfigured, and even resisted sometimes in practice. The rise of humanism in Britain is not religion by other means. To say it is to Lal Asad, and many others would remind us, is to say that religion would therefore have an essence. It is to say that religion is a thing whose characteristics can be repackaged but not remade. Humanism, in spite of Christianity, in spite of its Christianity, is different. Part of what we see in light of this ethnographic exploration is how this difference gets produced. At a local, grassroots level, there are a growing number of people throughout Britain who come together as humanists, and whose activities and perspectives as such play a role in defining religion today. Every time these people come together, every time they discuss medical ethics, every time they sing, every time they argue over whether they should sing, every time they take jibes at Catholics, every time they take offense at such jibes, every time they organize, attend, or facilitate a non-religious or humanist wedding or funeral, these are all acts and articulations of what it means to be religious and not. At the center of this contemporary humanist vision of religion is, of course, belief. To be religious is to be a believer, and to be a believer is to be a certain kind of person who brackets off as separate a set of truths not explicable in scientific or naturalistic terms. While in one sense this conclusion might seem akin to saying the sky is blue, or perhaps that the Pope is Catholic, we should not be so quick to conclude, as many historians, anthropologists, and others have pointed out, that belief has always been or will always be the defining feature of religiosity. So part of what contemporary humanism does is reinforce a certain post-Enlightenment conception of faith that locates it in a set of propositional assents. As some of the remarks by Audrey and John also suggest, this understanding of belief and religion is based upon a certain compartmentalization. Again, an Enlightenment, and even more specifically liberal conceit, that religion is a private matter, something that can be bracketed off. As John put it, there are some bits of religion, in the animated discussion that he had with others in the group about buildings and singing, there are some bits of religion that might be worth saving. To save these bits, humanism makes them not religious. Organized humanism is a project of clarification of the difference between what is cultural, religious belief, and natural, modes of sociality. The humanists don't want belief, but they do want belonging. They do want the sense of community, and even, in some cases, comfort that, as Sage put it, the church has provided as a default. Some of the humanists also want to sing, some want places of their own, and some of these people even want those places to be nice. Local action is one way, an important way, in which these elements of sociality and religiosity are being made. In this talk, I have considered some of humanism's relations to religion, and in particular, how humanists try to move themselves and society beyond faith. Humanists talk a lot about religion, and they think a lot about their connections, both historical and social, to religious traditions, beliefs, institutions, material culture, especially those relating to Christianity. And yet it is in spite of Christianity, I argue, that we must understand this particular flourishing of the human imagination. Thank you.